This CLE is based on the appellate decisions released in October of 2019 addressing criminal law issues. The summaries of these decisions were initially posted on the New York Appellate Digest website in October of 2019, and they've since been compiled in the October 2019 Criminal Law Update pamphlet. It's that pamphlet that serves as the written materials for this CLE, and the page references are to the pages in that pamphlet. The first case, People v. Hernandez, is on page 8. It deals with an appellate issue, whether the denial of a speedy trial motion can be appealed after entering a guilty plea. The general answer is no, but appeal was allowed in this case because the defendant was given the wrong information about that issue. Second department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that the court was wrong when it informed defendant he retained the right to appeal the ruling on the speedy trial motion, which was made pursuant to Criminal Procedure Law 3030, after his guilty plea. Therefore, defendant was entitled to the opportunity to withdraw his plea in this attempted murder case. The court wrote, "A defendant who has entered a plea of guilty forfeits his or her right to claim that he or she was deprived of a speedy trial under Criminal Procedure Law 30.30. However, where a defendant's plea is predicated upon a false assurance that notwithstanding the plea, the defendant can nonetheless contest the denial of the speedy trial motion, the defendant is entitled, if he or she wishes, to withdraw the plea of guilty." Next is People v. Allende. On page 9, it's a Court of Appeals case, and it deals with the Court of Appeals power of review. Court of Appeals, over an extensive two-judge dissenting opinion and another dissent, held that the modification by the appellate division could not be appealed. The court said, "An appellate division reversal or modification based on an unpreserved error is considered an exercise of the appellate division's interest of justice power. Moreover, the appellate division's characterization of its own holding, for instance, on the law or on the facts, is not binding in determining jurisdiction. We look behind that characterization to discern the basis of the ruling. Here it is undisputed that in vacating the first-degree robbery count without disturbing the second-degree robbery convictions, the appellate division relied upon an unpreserved argument concerning the proper interpretation of and minimum proof required to establish the weapon display element of the first-degree offense. As we have repeatedly recognized, for jurisdictional purposes, an unpreserved issue of this nature does not present a question of law. Thus, the appellate division determination, the basis of the order of modification, was not on the law alone, but was necessarily made as a matter of discretion in the interest of justice. And though, therefore, the ruling was not appealable to the Court of Appeals." Next is People v. Rong He, R-O-N-G-H-E. It's on page 12. It has to do with Brady material. Court of Appeals case. The Court of Appeals, reversing defendant's conviction, held that defendant should have been provided with exculpatory Brady evidence. Eyewitnesses to the assault made statements that there were two perpetrators, which directly contradicted the people's theory that defendant was the sole perpetrator. The court wrote, "Our inquiry turns to whether the suppressed information was material, which is one of the requirements for determining whether the failure to turn over exculpatory material is a reversible error. In New York, the test of materiality, where the defendant has made a specific request for the evidence in question, is whether there's a reasonable possibility that the verdict would have been different if the evidence had been disclosed. Both witnesses' statements, if true, would have directly contradicted the people's theory of the case that defendant was the sole perpetrator. Although the people presented other evidence of defendant's guilt, the only witness who identified defendant at trial, initially told the police that he did not see the perpetrator's face. Considering that the nightclub owner provided the police with the name of another possible assailant, and based on the other evidence presented at trial, it's clear that access at least to him could have allowed defendant to develop additional facts, which in turn could have aided him in establishing additional or alternative theories to support his defense. Given the substance of the nightclub owner's statements and the nature of the people's case, we cannot say, under our less demanding standard, that there was no reasonable possibility that the defense's investigation of the witnesses would not have affected the outcome of defendant's trial. Next is People v. Dibble on page 14. The court determined that attempted menacing of a police officer is not a cognizable crime. Fourth Department held that attempted menacing of a police officer is not a cognizable crime because attempt is included in the offense. This was a mode of proceedings error that did not have to be preserved. The court said, according to the definition of menacing a police officer or peace officer set forth in the penal law, the attempt to commit the crime is already an element of the offense, and there cannot be an attempt to commit a crime which is itself a mere attempt to do an act or accomplish a result. Although defendant failed to raise this issue at trial, preservation is not required, inasmuch as this issue constitutes a mode of proceedings error. Next is People v. Smith on pages 14 and 15. It's a double jeopardy case. Second Department, after the second trial was finished, held that the second trial violated the double jeopardy prohibition. In the first trial, a juror talked to an attorney about the evidence and during deliberations told the other jurors what the attorney said. That juror was disqualified. The people moved for a mistrial. The defendant opposed and was willing to proceed with 11 jurors, and the judge declared a mistrial over the objection of the defendant. The court wrote, while it is undisputed that juror number 11 was grossly unqualified to continue serving, the Supreme Court abused its discretion in declaring a mistrial without considering other alternatives. The defendant specifically indicated his desire to waive trial by a jury of 12 and proceed with the remaining 11, an option that has been endorsed by the Court of Appeals. Under the circumstances presented, as urged by defense counsel, it would have been appropriate to poll the remainder of the jurors to ascertain whether they could render an impartial verdict. Moreover, as the improper information imparted to the jurors did not significantly prejudice the people, the court should have considered whether a specific curative instruction could have clarified what constituted evidence and whether such an instruction could have cured the impropriety. Accordingly, there was an insufficient basis on the record for the declaration of a mistrial, and thus a retrial was precluded. Next is People v. Alenikoff on pages 15 and 16. It's another double jeopardy case. The case against the defendant was originally brought in federal court under a federal statute, and the Second Circuit reversed. Then the state prosecution, the instant prosecution, was brought, and upon conviction in state court, the defendant argued that he had been subjected to double jeopardy. The First Department held defendant's prosecution for unlawful use of secret scientific material did not violate the prohibition against double jeopardy. Defendant, while working for Goldman Sachs, had uploaded source code to a server in Germany. He was first charged under a federal statute, the National Stolen Property Act, or NSPA. The Second Circuit reversed the NSPA conviction because the source code was deemed intangible at the time of the theft when it was transmitted, and therefore did not meet the definition of goods in the federal statute. However, the state statute under which defendant was subsequently prosecuted, unlawful use of secret scientific material, included tangible, electronically reproduced material. And the source code reproduced on the German server met that criteria. As the court explained it, the Second Circuit did not hold that the source codes were intangible as they existed on the German server. Rather, it held that at the time of the theft, which was the same time as when the codes were transmitted, the codes were purely intangible. Because the elements of the two offenses, the federal and state offenses, are not equivalent, there's no inconsistency between the Second Circuit's determination that the codes were intangible when transported and this court's determination that defendant made a tangible reproduction when he uploaded them to the German server, where they resided within a physical medium. So because the elements of the federal and state offenses were different, the double jeopardy prohibition did not apply. Next is People v. Schneider on page 17. It's an eavesdropping case, and the issue is whether the court had jurisdiction to issue the eavesdropping warrant when messages were sent and received outside of New York State. The Second Department held Supreme Court had jurisdiction to issue eavesdropping warrants to intercept cell phone calls and text messages made and received outside New York State. The court wrote, "Any justice of the Supreme Court of the judicial district in which the eavesdropping warrant is to be executed," this is citing Criminal Procedure Law 700.05, Subdivision 4, "may issue an eavesdropping warrant upon ex parte application of an applicant who is authorized by law to investigate, prosecute, or participate in the prosecution of a particular designated offense." Although the word execute in the statute is not defined, the plain meaning of the word execute and the use of that word in relevant sections of the criminal procedure law reveal that an eavesdropping warrant is executed when a communication is intercepted by law enforcement officers. That is, when the communication is intentionally overheard or recorded by law enforcement officers. Here, the eavesdropping warrants were executed in Kings County, New York, where the communications were intercepted by the New York City Police Department. Therefore, under the applicable provisions of the criminal procedure law, a justice of the Supreme Court, Kings County, had jurisdiction to issue the eavesdropping warrants. Next is Matter of Hamrahi on pages 18 and 19. It's another jurisdiction case, this time involving a family offense, which was a proceeding in family court. The Second Department, reversing family court, held a hearing was necessary on whether the court had subject matter jurisdiction for the petition seeking an order of protection based on a family offense. The court wrote, "The family court is a court of limited subject matter jurisdiction and cannot exercise powers beyond those granted to it by statute. Pursuant to Family Court Act Section 812, Subdivision 1, the family court's jurisdiction in family offense proceedings is limited to certain prescribed criminal acts that occur between spouses or former spouses, or between parent and child, or between members of the same family or household. For purposes of Family Court Act Article 8, members of the same family or household include persons who are not related by consanguinity or affinity and who are or have been in an intimate relationship, regardless of whether such persons have lived together at any time. What qualifies as an intimate relationship within the meaning of Family Court Act Section 812 is determined on a case-by-case basis. Relevant factors include the nature or type of the relationship, regardless of whether the relationship is sexual in nature, the frequency of interaction between the persons, and the duration of the relationship. So the matter was sent back for a hearing to determine whether the relationship between the two parties met the jurisdictional requirements for a family offense proceeding in family court. Next is People v. Jones on page 19. It has to do with the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, and whether the jury should be able to hear someone exercise that privilege. The third department held that the trial judge properly refused to compel a witness, his name was Chandler, an accomplice in the defendant's offenses, so this was a defense witness, who asserted his Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination to testify or to assert the privilege in the presence of the jury. The court wrote, Chandler, who had entered a guilty plea but was awaiting sentencing, was produced in court. Outside the presence of the jury, Chandler's counsel indicated that Chandler intended to exercise his privilege against self-incrimination based on the possibility that he could further incriminate himself, expose himself to perjury charges, and or provide testimony that could adversely impact his upcoming sentencing proceeding. Chandler confirmed under oath that he would invoke the privilege if called as a witness, and when questioned by defendant in the context of that inquiry, did in fact invoke the privilege. Supreme Court acknowledged that Chandler's plea agreement was contingent upon no information coming to the court's attention about prior criminal conduct that the court did not know about. Such unknown prior criminal conduct could potentially include crimes relating to defendant's claim that Chandler coerced him into participating in the schemes to defraud. There was no basis for Supreme Court to conclude that Chandler's invocation of the privilege was clearly contumacious, nor was it patently clear that Chandler's testimony could not subject him to prosecution. Accordingly, we discern no abuse of discretion in Supreme Court's refusal to compel Chandler to testify or to require him to assert the privilege in the presence of the jury. Although defendant certainly had the right to call witnesses and present a defense, he had no right to compel testimony over a claim of recognized privilege. Next is People v. Ellison. This is on page 21. It has to do with a waiver of appeal. The Second Department held defendant's waiver of appeal was invalid because his consent to the waiver was not renewed after he pled to a different crime, after the initial sentence promise couldn't be met. The court wrote, Supreme Court was unable to fulfill its sentencing commitment because the sentence it had promised was illegal. Although the defendant ultimately agreed to plead guilty to a different crime in return for a different sentence, the modification of the material terms of the original plea agreement vitiated defendant's knowing and intelligent entry of the waiver of appeal. Under such circumstances, it was incumbent on the court to elicit defendant's continuing consent to waive his right to appeal. So the waiver was no longer in effect because the original sentencing promise couldn't be met and the defendant pled to a different offense. Next is Matter of Elijah X on page 22. It's a juvenile delinquency case involving a probation violation, and it's a proceeding in family court under the Family Court Act. Third Department, dismissing the petition, held that respondent, who had been adjudicated a juvenile delinquent, was not provided sufficient information before admitting to a probation violation. The court said, Family Court Act, Section 321.3, Subdivision 1, requires a court to advise a respondent of his or her right to a fact-finding hearing and to question both the respondent and his or her parent, if present, as to whether the respondent committed the act contained in the admission, whether the respondent is voluntarily waiving his or her right to a fact-finding hearing, and whether the respondent is aware of the possible specific dispositional orders. The allocution did not meet these statutory requirements. Although family court did advise respondent to some extent regarding his rights, the failure to meet the statutory mandates rendered the allocution inadequate. Critically, although respondent's mother was present, the court failed to question her regarding respondent's waiver of the fact-finding hearing or about his failure to attend counseling. Instead, respondent was merely asked whether he had sufficient time to speak to his parents about the allocution. Moreover, the court did not determine whether respondent and his mother understood the possible specific dispositional orders that might result from his allocution. Next is People versus Valerio on page 23. Has to do with the inability to meet a sentence promise. Fourth Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant was entitled to either the vacation of his guilty plea or the imposition of a sentence which conformed to the plea bargain. Defendant had pled guilty to a drug possession charge and was told at the time of the plea he would not serve more than a year and a half in addition to his concurrent Massachusetts sentence. However, the Massachusetts sentence was subsequently reduced because of a cooperation agreement. The court said, the reduction of the pre-existing sentence nullified a benefit that was expressly promised and was a material inducement to the guilty plea, that being the judge's specific representation that the defendant's guilty plea in New York would thereby extend his aggregate incarceratory term by a year and a half only. So because the sentence promise could not be fulfilled, the defendant was entitled to either a vacation of his guilty plea or the imposition of a sentence which conformed to the promised sentence. Next is People versus Roberts on pages 23 and 24, another guilty plea case. The Third Department, reversing county court, held defendant's plea to a probation violation was involuntary and must be vacated. The court wrote, the record reflects that the people's final plea offer came with a prison sentence of 1.5 years, followed by 6 years of post-release supervision. When defendant indicated that he wanted to admit to the probation violation and argue for a more lenient sentence, county court stated that it could not override the recommended sentence unless defendant declined the offer and proceeded to a hearing. The court further told defendant that if he took the offer, it was up to the people as to whether a lesser sentence could be considered. The people then turned down defendant's proposal to cap his sentencing exposure at 1.5 years in prison and stated that they would recommend a higher sentence if defendant rejected the offer and was found guilty following a hearing. Defendant thereafter accepted the offer. The foregoing reflects, and the people concede, that county court abdicated its responsibility to carefully consider all facts available at the time of sentencing and fashion an appropriate sentence. Inasmuch as the proceedings were also marred by the people's admittedly inappropriate threat to seek a harsher sentence if defendant rejected the offer and was found guilty after a hearing, the plea itself was involuntary. Therefore, defendant is entitled to vacate his plea. Next is People versus Costello on pages 24 and 25. It's an identification case. Second Department held the witness's identification of the defendant from photographs properly survived the motion to dismiss. The presumption of suggestiveness was overcome by the evidence of the sheer number of photographs shown to the witness. The court said, although the people did not produce in court the photographic arrays displayed through the use of the photo manager system, which gives rise to a presumption of suggestiveness, the people nevertheless rebutted that presumption and sustained their initial burden through the testimony of the detective, which established that she utilized the various databases applying the description of the perpetrator supplied by the complainant. The detective testified that the complainant was shown the computer-generated photo arrays a day after the incident occurred, and then again 3 days later. The detective's unrebutted testimony established that 700 to 1,000 photographs were generated by the photo manager system, which were displayed in smaller arrays of photographs, from which, during the third viewing session, the complainant identified the defendant as the person who assaulted her. When a photographic identification procedure involves showing a witness a pre-existing file consisting of a large number of photographs, The sheer volume and scope of the procedure militates against the presence of suggestiveness. Moreover, the complainant eventually identified the defendant in a lineup. Next is People v. Alexander on page 26. It has to do with whether jurors should have been questioned further about problems they were having. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the trial judge should have conducted further inquiry when three jurors stated that they could not continue deliberating because they were not being paid by their employers for the days they were on jury duty. The court wrote, "The court should have granted the defense request for inquiries into whether the financial pressure the jurors were experiencing had any bearing on their ability to deliberate fairly." In People v. Hines, this court held that although financial hardship is generally not a sufficient reason to warrant a discharge when the trial is near completion, the trial court should have ascertained whether the juror's financial difficulties would have affected his ability to deliberate impartially. Similarly, in People v. Cook, we observed that a juror's personal or financial inconvenience alone would be insufficient to establish the requisite manifest necessity for a mistrial, but we went on to state that the fact that the juror was unable to declare her continued ability to deliberate fairly weighed in favor of a mistrial. Here, the jury's note raised the possibility that one or more of the jurors referred to was unqualified, and the fact that they did not specifically volunteer in their colloquies with the court that financial pressures might compromise their impartiality did not obviate the necessity of an inquiry. Next is People v. Jackson on page 28. It has to do with for-cause challenges to jurors. The Third Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held the defense for-cause challenges to two jurors should have been granted in this rape prosecution. The court wrote, "During the voir dire, when counsel asked prospective juror number two if she thought that this was the right case for her to sit on, she responded, 'I'm not sure. I teach youth. I have five children. That's where my sympathy would lie. The victim was probably about 20 years old. I would have a tendency to be biased in that direction.' Counsel then asked if those thoughts might make it difficult for prospective juror number two to weigh the evidence. She responded, 'I don't think so. I think I could be unbiased. I do lean toward sympathy with the youth. That's where my life is.' She then mentioned that she was very involved in church youth organizations and teaches 9th and 10th grade girls. Prospective juror number three acknowledged that he was having a hard time listening to the subject matter of the case during the voir dire because he has four younger sisters and a daughter. When asked if he could get beyond the allegations and really weigh the evidence, or whether that might be a problem, he responded, 'I'd like to say I could be impartial, but until everything comes out, it's difficult to say.' No further questions were asked of these potential jurors by counsel or by the judge. Supreme Court denied defendants' challenges to these prospective jurors for cause, asserting that each had said he or she could be fair and impartial. Although prospective juror number two did say she could be unbiased, she again stated immediately thereafter that she leaned toward sympathy with youth and worked with young girls, indicating an inclination toward the young female victim. Prospective juror number three made an equivocal statement regarding his partiality. As neither prospective juror unequivocally stated that he or she could be impartial, the court should have posed questions to rehabilitate them by obtaining such assurances, or, if rehabilitation was not possible, excused the prospective jurors. Next is People v. Newlander. Court of Appeals case on page 29 has to do with juror misconduct. Court of Appeals, in a full-fledged opinion by Judge Wilson, affirming the appellate division, held that juror misconduct deprived the defendant, Dr. Newlander, of a fair trial. The court wrote, "A jury convicted Dr. Newlander of murdering his wife and tampering with physical evidence. Throughout the trial, one of the jurors, juror 12, sent and received hundreds of text messages about the case. Certain text messages sent and received by juror 12 were troublesome and inconsistent with the trial court's repeated instructions not to discuss the case with any person and to report any attempts by anyone to discuss the case with a juror. Juror 12 also accessed local media websites that were covering the trial extensively. In order to hide her misconduct, Juror 12 lied under oath to the court, deceived the people and the court by providing a false affidavit and tendering doctored text message exchanges in support of that affidavit, selectively deleted other text messages she deemed problematic, and deleted her now irretrievable internet browsing history. The cumulative effect of Juror 12's extreme deception and dishonesty compels us to conclude that her improper conduct may have affected a substantial right of the defendant. And they cite Criminal Procedure Law, Section 330.30, Subdivision 2. Next is Matter of Vance on pages 30 and 31. It deals with the judge's power to send criminal cases involving a juvenile to family court. The First Department denied the People's Article 78 action seeking to vacate an order by the respondent judge severing two counts which had been combined in an indictment and removing the charges to family court. The People objected to removing the prosecution of a 16-year-old to family court. In order to facilitate the removal, respondent judge severed the two counts. The People unsuccessfully argued the judge did not have the authority to sever the counts and therefore could not send the charges to family court. The court wrote, "The law is clear that the determination of whether the charges were in fact properly joinable in the first instance is a duty of the court that is not delegated to the prosecution or the grand jury. While the People disagree with the court's finding that the charges were not properly joinable under Criminal Procedure Law, Section 200.20, determination of this issue is not before us in this Article 78 proceeding. Rather, we are only asked, and we have only the authority, to determine whether the court acted without jurisdiction or in excess of its authority." And obviously, the Third Department felt the judge had the authority to sever those counts and send them to family court. Next is People v. Calderon on pages 31 and 32. It has to do with the defendant's right to be present at material stages of the trial. In this case, an argument about Molyneux evidence. The First Department, reversing defendant's conviction, held that defendant's absence from the judge's ruling on whether Molyneux evidence was admissible violated his right to be present at material stages of the trial. Although the defendant was present when the Molyneux arguments were made, the prosecutor made further arguments at the time of the ruling when the defendant was not present, which led to additional Molyneux evidence being presented at trial. The court said defendant should have been afforded the opportunity to be present given that the prosecutor's introduction of new facts, in effect, expanded the original Molyneux application and involved factual matters of which defendant may have had peculiar knowledge. Defendant was in the best position to either deny the new factual details, point out the errors in the prosecutor's account of the details, or provide defense counsel with details that would have been useful in advancing his position. Next case is on pages 32 and 33, People v. Hightower, Court of Appeals case. It deals with a jurisdictional defect in a misdemeanor complaint. The Court of Appeals, in a two-sentence memorandum decision, followed by two lengthy concurring opinions and a lengthy three-judge dissenting opinion, determined the appellate term properly reversed defendant's guilty plea to a jurisdictionally defective count of a misdemeanor complaint. The top count of the misdemeanor complaint, which was oxycodone possession, was not sufficiently supported by the factual deposition. But the lesser counts of the complaint, marijuana possession, were supported. Defendant pled guilty to the top count. Defendant's guilty plea did not waive the jurisdictional defect. The court wrote, even if the accusatory instrument properly sets out a lower grade offense, a defendant's challenge to a conviction based on the jurisdictional deficiency of a higher grade crime of a multi-count complaint is not waived by the defendant's guilty plea. The appellate term properly reversed the judgment of conviction and sentence on the ground that it was jurisdictionally defective as to the crime of which defendant was actually convicted. Next is People v. Watts on pages 33 and 34. The issue is whether the defendant opened the door to the presentation of more prior crime evidence, more Molyneux evidence. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction in this child sex abuse prosecution, held that the trial court should not have allowed the prosecution to present all evidence of defendant's alleged prior sexual abuse of children after defense counsel asked complainants whether they had hired a lawyer and were suing the defendant teacher and the school district based upon defendant's alleged sexual abuse of children. Redirect should have been limited to only the evidence necessary to clarify and explain the reasons for the witnesses hiring a lawyer and bringing a lawsuit. The Second Department also noted that the trial judge should not have participated in the readback of testimony, and the harmless error analysis is not applicable. The court wrote, defense counsel asked questions regarding the civil actions in an attempt to impeach credibility and establish that a motivation for some of the complainant's testimony against the defendant was monetary gain or a pecuniary interest. This line of inquiry did not open an unfettered passageway for the people to elicit extensive and prejudicial evidence regarding alleged uncharged complaints. The extraneous testimony of alleged uncharged complaints did not serve to explain or clarify whether the civil actions provided certain complainants with a financial incentive to testify. Moreover, the admission of evidence of alleged uncharged complaints violated the basic principle underlying Molyneux that a criminal case should be tried on the facts and not on the basis of a defendant's propensity to commit the crime charged. Next is People v. Delano F. on page 34. It looks at an appellate issue. Second Department held that no appeal lies from the denial of a motion to withdraw a plea of not responsible by reason of mental disease or defect. The court basically looked at all the relevant statutes and found that there was no statutory provision which allowed this appeal. The court wrote, Criminal Procedure Law 450.10 only provides that a defendant may appeal as of right from a judgment, sentence, or order made pursuant to specific provisions of Criminal Procedure Law Article 440, and thus does not provide for appellate review as of right from an order denying a motion pursuant to Criminal Procedure Law 220.60 to withdraw a plea of not responsible by reason of mental disease or defect. Nor does Criminal Procedure Law 450.15 allow for such an appeal by permission, as that statute only permits an appeal from orders made pursuant to specific provisions of Criminal Procedure Law Article 440 and a sentence not otherwise appealable as of right. Finally, there is no avenue for appeal through Criminal Procedure Law 330.20, which permits a party to proceedings conducted in accordance with the provisions of this section to appeal by permission from certain orders rendered under Criminal Procedure Law, Section 330.20. The orders specified do not include an order denying a motion pursuant to Criminal Procedure Law 220.60 to withdraw the plea. Next is Matter of Justin M. on page 35. It deals with the interplay between an order of protection issued in a criminal matter and a subsequent family court matter. The Third Department, reversing family court, held that an order of protection issued in a criminal proceeding before the child was born did not prohibit contact between the child and father. Father's petition seeking custody and or parenting time should not have been dismissed on that ground. The court wrote, at the initial appearance on the petition, family court stated that the order of protection had been issued in a criminal matter and that it barred the putative father from having any direct or indirect contact with the mother. The mother then moved to dismiss the petition, arguing that the order of protection rendered the petition moot. Family court agreed and granted the motion, and the father appeals. The order of protection at issue, a copy of which is not in the record, but the terms of which we take judicial notice, was issued prior to the child's birth and does not bar the putative father from having contact with the child. It is not, therefore, fatal to the putative father's petition. Remittal is therefore required for family court to consider whether an order of filiation should be issued, and if so, whether contact with the putative father would be in the best interest of the child and could be accomplished without contravening the terms of the order of protection. Next is matter of Cobb on pages 35 and 36. It deals with the constitutionality of a condition of parole. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the condition of petitioner's post-release supervision prohibiting him from entering Queens County, where the assault victim resides, without any option to travel there with permission, violated petitioner's right to travel and right to associate, and was arbitrary and capricious. The court said, release conditions that implicate certain fundamental rights, such as the right to travel and the right to associate, have been held permissible as long as reasonably related to a petitioner's criminal history and future chances of recidivism. Barring petitioner from the entire county of Queens under all circumstances, without any clear right to seek or ability to obtain a waiver from respondents, is a categorical ban impinging upon his rights to travel and association. And for this reason alone, the travel restriction must be vacated as arbitrary and capricious, as it is not reasonably related to petitioner's criminal history and future chances of recidivism. Accordingly, we remand this matter for respondents to issue a new travel restriction. The restriction must be clear and reasonably related to petitioner's criminal history and future chances of recidivism. Unlike the vacated restriction, the new restriction should specify that any travel restrictions are subject to case-by-case exceptions for legitimate reasons, which petitioner may request from his parole officer. Next is People v. Waldron, which is on page 40. It has to do with restitution. The Third Department, over a two-justice dissent, held that defendant is entitled to the opportunity to withdraw his plea because the amount of restitution ordered by the sentencing judge was about $500 higher than the amount agreed to in the plea deal. Next is People v. Peloso on pages 40 and 41. It's a right to counsel case. Second Department, reversing defendant's conviction on several counts in the interest of justice because the evidence was legally insufficient, noted that a new trial was required on the remaining counts because defendant was deprived of his right to counsel. The trial judge told the defendant he could not discuss his trial testimony with his counsel during a two-day adjournment. The court wrote, with regard to the 3rd and 17th through 23rd counts of the indictment, the defendant's convictions must be reversed because he was deprived of the right to counsel when the county court instructed him not to discuss his trial testimony with his attorney during a two-day adjournment. Although the defendant failed to preserve this issue for appellate review, we reached the issue as a matter of discretion in the interest of justice. Next is People v. Santiago on page 41. It's a search and seizure case. Second Department held Supreme Court properly suppressed statements made without Miranda warnings, including the consent to search a safe, as well as the firearm seized from the safe. Although defendant was on parole in New Jersey, the search was done in Queens by New York City police. Therefore, the consent to search provided by parolees as a condition of parole in New Jersey was not applicable. The court wrote, although Soto had consented to searches by New Jersey parole officers as a condition of his parole, the record reveals that the New York Police Department officers, not the New Jersey parole officers, searched the safe after they were notified that the New Jersey parole officers found what appeared to be heroin in the apartment. Accordingly, the people cannot rely on Soto's consent given as a condition of parole to justify the warrantless search of the safe. Next is People v. Richards on page 42. It's a warrantless search case. The Third Department held a warrantless search and seizure of a meth lab was valid, and defendant's motion to suppress was properly denied. Four police officers went to defendant's property based upon a tip defendant was operating a meth lab. Before going to the property, the police learned defendant and his girlfriend had purchased Sudafed, which is used to make methamphetamine, and that their subsequent attempts to buy Sudafed were denied. Once on the property, Officer DeMuth was able to see into the lab through a partially open door. He entered the lab allegedly because he feared for the safety of persons in a nearby trailer. The court wrote, DeMuth testified that his observations, together with his knowledge of the tip and the information obtained from the National Precursor Log, led him to believe that there was an active methamphetamine lab inside the shed. He stated that based upon his training and experience regarding the dangers of methamphetamine production, particularly the risk of explosion, he immediately became concerned for the safety of the inhabitants of the trailer, which included several children, as well as himself and his fellow officers, and that he fully opened the door to the shed to provide ventilation. DeMuth's testimony demonstrated that he had objectively reasonable grounds for believing that the contents of the shed posed an immediate danger to everyone present on the scene, and thus that his actions in opening the door to the shed were justified. Next is People v. Lambie, L-A-M-B-E-Y, on page 43. The Second Department, reversing county court, held the motion to suppress should not have been granted without a hearing because the defense counsel had not been provided with a copy of the search warrant at the time the motion was made. The court wrote, we disagree with the county court's decision to deny that branch of the defendant's omnibus motion which sought to controvert the search warrant without holding a hearing, as defense counsel did not have access to even a redacted copy of the search warrant at the time the motion was made. Although in moving to controvert the search warrant, defense counsel did not make precise factual averments, he was not required to do so as he did not have access to the search warrant applications at issue. Next is People v. Turner on pages 43 and 44. It has to do with the requirements that must be met before a strip search is considered appropriate. The Third Department, reversing defendant's drug possession conviction, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Mulvey, held that the police did not have a reasonable suspicion defendant was concealing drugs on his person at the time of the strip search. The drugs found in the search should have been suppressed. The court said, strip searches cannot be routinely undertaken as incident to all drug arrests, but must be based on specific and articulable facts which, along with any logical deductions, reasonably prompted the intrusion. Courts consider several factors when determining whether, under the totality of the circumstances, the police had reasonable suspicion to conduct a strip search, including the defendant's excessive nervousness, unusual conduct, information showing pertinent criminal propensities, informant's tips, loose-fitting or bulky clothing, an itinerary suggestive of wrongdoing, incriminating matter discovered during a less intrusive search, lack of employment, indications of drug addiction, information derived from others arrested or searched contemporaneously, and evasive or contradictory answers to questions. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code for the attorney affirmation for this October 2019 criminal law CLE. The verification code is warrant. Again, the verification code for this October 2019 criminal law CLE is warrant. Next is People v. Ward on pages 44 and 45, another search case. Second Department held defendant's motion to suppress on the ground that corrections officers, who are not police officers, participated in the search of his property was properly denied. The court said, although the criminal procedure law only authorizes a police officer to execute a search warrant, the participation by an individual who does not meet the statutory definition is not inherently improper. Indeed, courts have upheld the validity of a search where civilians participated in the execution of a search warrant. Under such circumstances, civilians who act at the behest of the state are treated as police agents, subject to the same controls and restrictions of the Fourth Amendment as the police themselves. Next is People v. Burden on pages 45 and 46. It's a case dealing with the Sex Offender Registration Act. The First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant need not register as a sex offender in New York based upon a Connecticut misdemeanor conviction, which was not equivalent to New York's first-degree sexual abuse statute. The court noted that the civil appeals standard applies. So the civil appeals standard applies to cases involving the Sex Offender Registration Act. And preservation of the error was not required because the appeal presents a pure question of law. The issue could not have been avoided if raised below, and the record is sufficient for review. The court said, the issue is properly reviewable on this appeal, notwithstanding defendant's failure to raise it before the hearing court. While we agree with the people that preservation considerations applicable to civil appeals apply here, those considerations do not bar review. This appeal presents a pure question of law. The issue could not have been avoided if raised before the hearing court, and it is reviewable on the existing record. Moreover, the hearing court expressly ruled on the issue in its detailed decision. Next is People v. Torres on pages 46 and 47, another Sex Offender Registration Act case involving a risk assessment. The Second Department reduced the defendant's sex offender level from 3 to 2 because the evidence of an uncharged sexual offense was not sufficient. The court said, while the people presented DNA evidence establishing that the defendant had sexual contact with the second alleged victim, the only evidence of that alleged victim's age was a statement in a police report that she was 15 years old. And since the police report stated that the alleged victim's sexual contact with the defendant was willing, the bare notation of the victim's age was the only proof of the crime on which the people relied. Thus, the Supreme Court should not have granted an upward departure since the evidence of the alleged victim's age was not supported by a detailed victim statement or otherwise corroborated. Next is People v. Koss, C-O-S-S, on page 48. It has to do with the requirements for a superior court information. Third Department, resolving a question of first impression, held that a superior court information is jurisdictionally defective if it charges a joinable offense which is greater in degree than the offense for which the defendant was held for the action of the grand jury. The jurisdictional question survives the guilty plea, the failure to preserve, and the waiver of appeal. The court wrote, we conclude that a joinable offense may not be included in a waiver of indictment and superior court information unless that offense, or a lesser included offense, was charged in a felony complaint and the defendant was therefore held for the action of a grand jury upon that charge. Next is People v. Turner on page 49. It has to do with the validity of a traffic stop. Fourth Department held, 1. The left turn made by the defendant from the rightmost lane did not violate Vehicle and Traffic Law Section 1160. And 2. The officer who stopped the defendant reasonably believed the turn was a traffic violation. Therefore, the traffic stop was justified. The court wrote, suppression of the seized weapon is not required here because the stop was the result of the officer's objectively reasonable belief that he observed a traffic violation. In light of the reality that an officer may suddenly confront a situation in the field as to which the application of a statute is unclear, however clear it may later become, an officer's misreading of a statute that is susceptible of multiple interpretations and has not been definitively construed by New York appellate courts may amount to a reasonable mistake of law justifying a traffic stop. Notwithstanding our interpretation of Vehicle and Traffic Law, Section 1160, Subdivision B, which is laid out above in the decision, the right of center line language is, in our view, susceptible of multiple interpretations, including the interpretation taken by the officer here, and the ambiguity has not previously been definitively construed. And I'll just note for the last case in this CLE, it's People v. Walley, W-A-L-L-E-Y, on page 50. It has to do with the requirements for a waiver of indictment and a superior court information. The case held that it was a jurisdictional error for the waiver of indictment and the superior court information to not include the time and place of each offense that was charged. And the court held in Wally that that was a jurisdictional defect which did not need to be preserved. However, since that case was decided in October of 2019, in November of 2019, People v. Thomas, a Court of Appeals case, decided that this type of deficiency, the failure to include the time and place of an offense in a superior court information and a waiver of indictment, is not a jurisdictional defect, and therefore it's subject to the preservation requirement. So again, that Court of Appeals case is People v. Thomas, and the slip opinion is 2019 New York Slip Opinion 08545, and that was issued on November 26th, 2019. And that concludes this October 2019 Criminal Law Update CLE.